All right, very good. Thank you very much, and thanks for inviting me to talk a little bit about some of the details of what we're doing with the parallaxes of Cepheids in the Milky Way and how that helps us measure H-naught. This is a topic that's already been covered in many ways in previous talks, so I'm going to focus only on some specific aspects of it and maybe drill down a little bit on the Gaia side and see why I think that it's pretty obvious that Gaia parallaxes will eventually give us the very best shot at 1% calibration for the Cepheids only. We need to improve other parts of the measurement as well, more supernova, et cetera, to reach 1% for H-naught. But with Gaia, I think within a year or so, we'll have 1% calibration for Cepheids. So you've already seen this plot many times. There are the three steps that we take to measure H-naught with shoes, the calibration of our of the Cepheids done with different anchors, the Milky Way, the LMC, M31, which we don't really use at the moment, but eventually we could, and NGC 4258, then the calibration of supernovae with Cepheids, done nearby supernovae with Cepheids, and the calibration of the supernovae in Hubble flow using the supernovae, the local supernovae. So I'm going to focus on this part and especially on the Milky Way side. So at the moment, we calibrate Cepheids in five different ways. Two of them have been improved recently by external work. So NGC 4258, we heard yesterday from Mark Reed that it's improved almost by factor two, maybe one and a half. The number for H-naught does not change much, but the precision has changed significantly. The LMC has improved very recently with Pachinski and his group. It's now 1%, 1.5% precision for H-naught. This, I should emphasize, this is a precision for H-naught, for the calibration of the Cepheids only in distance, not the precision of H-naught, which includes other elements as well. And then there are three ways of measuring parallaxes of Cepheids in the Milky Way. Many years ago, there was a work done with the HECFGSs with nominally a small error, but these are short period Cepheids, so they're not quite as good. And also for these, we don't have HST photometry, so that it introduces some additional systematics. And then recently, we had eight parallaxes measured from HST spatial scanning, and also the 50 parallaxes that we got for Cepheids with Gaia in DR2. And I say only 50 because, again, we need HST photometry. We obtained HST photometry for these stars. So in the end, what we do is just for Milky Way Cepheids, we have three different ways to make the calibration. There are different methods, different systematics, different likely errors, but the results are always consistent. So let me move on a little bit. So just spend a few minutes on this method that we use, for which we use HST. It was a lot of work, so we like to look to show the results, but it really was difficult. So in any event, let me just say, basically what you expect for a Cepheid, you expect it to move with respect to background stars between with a cadence of about a year of 6 months from one side to the other. You want to measure the parallax, which you could simplify as a separation with one of nearby stars. The precision of the positional measurement for HST normally is about 400 microarc seconds, 0.4 milliarc seconds, 100th of a pixel. That's using wide field camera 3. But by taking a scan and moving the telescope while you're observing the field, you are actually able to collect many, many more photons and also average over irregularities in the pixels, and that allows you to make a much better measurement. So eventually, this distance can be measured not to 0.4 milliarc seconds, but more to about 20 to 40 microarc seconds per epoch. And doing that multiple times and for several Cepheids, we eventually obtained, after about 4 years of observations of up to 9 epochs, these are essentially the motions in the parallax direction for each of these Cepheids after removing the proper motion. So that's only the parallactic motion. And these are the measurements we had for the Cepheids. I think Adam would agree that this probably is the hardest problem with either of us has done, and it's cost many years of our life. And in the end, we expected to do better, I have to say. We found out that there were many things that were changing in the telescope at a very low level, and you needed many more reference stars than we had to be able to handle those. And so in the end, our measurements were only about 3.3%. We were hoping for more like 2%. But this is the result. Now, Gaia was coming, so we prepared. We prepared by taking observations of 50 selected Cepheids at what we felt was the golden place in terms of reddening, distance, period, etc., with HST, in order to have photometry that was consistent with all of the distant Cepheids, so we did not have any issue with photometric systems, etc. Now, these Cepheids are very bright for HST, so in order to obtain photometry, we actually had to use scanning again. We scanned very, very fast, 7 arc seconds per second. So basically, exposure time is about 1/100th of a second per pixel. And so that allowed us to actually not saturate for these objects. So we selected these 50, we obtained observations, and then we waited for the R2 to come, and the R2 came, and we're very happy. But, so these are our 50 Cepheids. 3 of them are anomalous, and in 2 cases at least, this is the cross profile of the scan that shows there is a companion. So presumably that's the reason. One of them is a very large anomalous parallax. And also we had one star, we'll show it later, T. Monocerotis, which is very close to the saturation. So we rejected those 4, so we had 46 parallaxes. What happened though is we realized very quickly that there was evidence for some kind of an offset in the parallax. This is the predicted distance for the predicted parallax from the photometry for these Cepheids with a particular calibration, but it doesn't matter. It only changes, only tilts the line if you change the calibration. And on the vertical axis, we have the measurement for the R2. These are the residuals, and you can see that there appears to be an offset. It's noisy at this level, but it's pretty clear. And of course, at the time of the R2, the team also said that there was a parallax offset. So in a sense, it was not really a surprise. And Anthony is explaining to us in great detail how that worked and how that was characterized. And the important thing to keep in mind is that this offset is not really a constant, but it depends, as you pointed out, on magnitude, color, position, source, and perhaps other parameters. So this is these plots are from Lindegren's paper. They show essentially the median of the parallax measure for about half a million QSOs that were observed in the R2. And you can see that there is an apparent constant offset here at about 30 minus 29 microarc seconds is the actual number. But as you go to brighter magnitudes, this is 18, 19, 20 in G, as you go to brighter magnitudes, there are not very many QSOs, but it goes to larger values, about 50 or 40. Our Cepheids are in this range, so about 50, 60 microarc seconds. There's also a color dependence. There's a tilt here. It's very hard to measure. Again, most of the QSOs are relatively blue. Our Cepheids are red, redder, certainly. So it's hard to know how to match these two. This is a function of ecliptic latitude. A few months later, at the IU Symposium 348, Leonard presented this plot, which collected several bits of different information from various elements in literature, plus the data were presented in Frederick Arnoux's paper, and it showed again there's some variation in the offset, mostly at the bright end. So one of the things we asked ourselves, oh, and by the way, we did also some other tests. These are all the fundamental mode Cepheids in the VAR Cepheid DR2 catalog that were essentially population 1, delta Cepheid type, and a few other selections, and not in the LMC, of course. And we, for each of those, we only used Gaia photometry, but we calibrated their distance with by doing a transformation to our system. So this is not very accurate, but it's a start. And if you look at the comparison between the predicted distance parallax and the observed parallax, this is the difference. It's not a zero. It's not at minus 40, which is a number that seems to be valid at this magnitude. It goes to a larger value towards brighter magnitude. So there's a clear magnitude effect. And there's actually, we also saw a magnitude effect in NGC, in the global cluster NGC 1697. These are all the stars brighter than 17 within 0.3 arc seconds and the right 0.3 degrees of the center of the cluster and with the right promotions. And you can see again that there is a slow but significant tilt towards larger offsets at brighter magnitudes. This is not seen in all clusters. This was seen in NGC 3697, but it's not general. So one of the questions we asked ourselves is, why should magnitude be so important for this offset? And we don't have all the information about the details of the solution process. We don't understand it fully, but one of the things we know is that as a star crosses the focal, so forgive me, this is much more schematic picture than the very beautiful pictures that you had, but as a star crosses the focal plane and gets its position measured in each of these CCDs, here or here or here, here, schematically what happens is if the star is faint, it'll just go across and be measured at the end when it's read out. But if the star is bright, its signal will be reset at various places by gating, and so in effect, the signal that's measured here will only be a fraction of the detector. So bright stars sample a different fraction of the focal plane than faint stars. And that is especially important as the magnitude becomes brighter and brighter towards sixth magnitude. The sixth magnitude, as you said, it just saturates it regardless of gating. So this is one reason why there may be a problem with at the bright end. And in fact, this is also from Leonard's paper in 2018. If you look at the difference between the parallax measured on the early part of the focal plane, which is this side, or the late part of the focal plane, which is this side, which is closer to the optical center, that difference is essentially flat and negligible up to 13th, and then it becomes significant brighter than 13th. So these are indications that really magnitude may very well be, from our perspective, one of the key elements. But in practice, what can we do? Well, we did something very simple. All of our Cepheids are essentially the same color, more or less. They vary, so it's not exactly true, but they are closer to being uniform in magnitude as well. And there are different places in the sky, so we actually assumed that there was a constant offset for all of them, because same magnitude, same color roughly, and then they were scattered due to the position in the sky, which we cannot control really very well. They're all along essentially the galactic plane. So we decided that to solve for an additive and a multiplicative term simultaneously. The additive term is the parallax offset. The multiplicative term is essentially a proxy for a change in the Cepheid calibration. If you change the Cepheid calibration, just multiply all the parallaxes by a constant factor, right? So there is a range of parallaxes, so actually there is some ability to separate an additive and a multiplicative term. So we solve for them simultaneously, and then we obtained for the parallax offset, -46 ± 13 microseconds, and for the scale term, 0.8% ± 3.3%, which is still quite far from the Planck value, but of course it's only 3.3%. There is covariance. The reason there is covariance is because the parallax range is not very big. So we don't have as much leverage as we would like to separate out additive and multiplicative terms. Also, when you look at the scatter, a residual scatter after these two corrections, we find that the scatter is about 20% larger than the nominal errors after the corrected nominal errors. And that may be due either to some underestimated errors, or it could be due to an additional variation in the offset due to position, which we cannot treat directly. So if there is a residual for that would be seen in the scatter, in the residual scatter. So by doing this, we're able to actually obtain a parallax that was a calibration of the Cepheids that was noisier than we had hoped, but presumably unbiased. And in fact, it turned out to be very consistent with all the other calibrations. We also did, other people have presented various ways to do the same calibration. This is based on the Zinn et al. Paper that also came out in 2018, where they used astroseismology information from red giants to calibrate the zero point. If you use their zero point, we find some very similar results. And actually, the next talk by Victor Chen will show some other methods to calibrate the zero point for the parallax. So I think this is something that people are paying a lot of attention to, and I would say fairly successfully. So you just have to be careful, as Anthony said. So what next? Can we do better? Well, first of all, we are hoping and we're confident that DR3 will improve the results reduce the systematics, maybe provide better understanding of systematics, and presumably have also smaller errors. But without even thinking about that, what we did is we decided, what if we improve the leverage that we have on the parallax offset from our sample? In order to do that, these are the 50 milkweeds have Cepheids we had photometry for. And they're all essentially, because we wanted long period of Cepheids, we focused on objects that were 2 kiloparsecs or further, so parallax less than 0.5 milliarc seconds. Well, we have proposed to observe 40 more Cepheids, galactic Cepheids, shorter period generally, but much closer. Now, for the closer Cepheids, we have much better leverage on on the scale, and for the further Cepheids, we have much better leverage on the offset. So by having a much broader range in parallaxes, not from 0.2 to 0.5, but from 0.2 to almost 1.8, we now predict that we will be able to do a much better separation between the offset and the scale term, and therefore obtain a better constraint on the parallax offset and a better calibration. So if we just use the DR2 errors and simulated data, et cetera, the ellipse that we had was, So the blue ellipse is what we had with our original sample. The black would be the one we have with the new sample, which is much more sensitive to the scale. And no, it's the other way around. Anyways, but in the yellow ellipse is what we expect when we use the combined sample. And so the error at that point would be, this predicted error would be about 0.8% if we use the R2 errors, just from the statistical approach. Now, this program was approved. It's a SNAP program, so it probably would be executed only about 50 or 60%. So, but in the end, if you include also the improvement of DR3, we are very confident that this will give us a better than 1% calibration based on the Cepheids with DR3 data only and our own separation, even if there is a residual offset, because we can determine the offset internally. So I've actually finished, so let me just summarize what I said. First of all, I'd like to emphasize again, we have, several people have said it, but it bears repeating, systematics is the name of the game. We want to make sure that we cover measurements in many different ways, because that allows us to understand better that we're not making a mistake somewhere that we're not aware of. It's the best way to limit the impact of unknown unknowns. So for us, that means that doing multiple ways of measuring the Cepheids, to calibrate the Cepheids, is a very critical part of our approach. And so far, everything has shown consistent results. And so we have the LMC value, which at the moment it formally is the best precision, the NGC 4258 value, which is improving significantly. That improvement is not included here, and also the Milky Way parallaxes with three different methods. We do need to have HST photometry to avoid systematics, so that's why the FGS method is not as useful at the moment. The status of the Gaia parallaxes, they're currently still affected by the DR2 offset issue. The consequence of that is that we have determined the offset internally from the Cepheid sample, so believe we are systematically correct, but the effective accuracy has been reduced by factor 2.5. Instead of 1/3% we expected, it's been about 3.3%. But with the new HST observations and the likely improvements with DR3, we expect that in about a year, Gaia will be the best of these five methods, and in fact will be well below 1%. And thank you.
Very nice talk, Stefano. My question actually is for Anthony. Looking at this approach, is this the way one should calibrate out the zero point for your source? Do you have any recommendations? You know, this is almost like a work example for a specific kind of source. Maybe you would have some guidance.
No, I think that's the way to go. I mean, you can maybe debate the details of the method itself, but yeah, no, it just looks fine.
One thing confused me. You said positional differences for the Cepheids maps into a slope into the parallax correction. I didn't follow that. Could you?
No, I'm sorry. Let me try and clarify. If you say change the photometric zero point for the Cepheid pyroluminosity law, that means you make all the Cepheids brighter by 0.5 magnitudes. That means you make all the Cepheids further away at a given observed magnitude by a factor of 1.7. I can't do it in my head, but 0.5 magnitudes, right? And so that's basically a slope in that line. When the line between the photometric predicted photometric distance and measured parallax, it's parallax versus parallax. So it's essentially a scale change in the distance. Therefore, it's a slope in that line. Does that make sense?
So you had 50 stars for you, which you had photometric parallaxes. And I guess what you're saying is the difficulty of doing your 8 scanning parallaxes was so difficult, you're not going to get an additional sample that is observed with HST parallaxes.
I think there's been a little bit of the photometric parallaxes were used simply to establish that there was a connection between the Gaia measurements and what we expected. The photometric parallaxes are for display purposes, essentially, to highlight how things work. If you change the calibration basically there is a free parameter in that photometric parallax, which is the calibration of the Cepheid pyroluminosity law. If you change that, you're basically stretching or shrinking all of the photometric parallaxes. So the photometric parallaxes were used for display purposes. They're not used in any calculation.
Yeah. No, I understand that. It was just a question of whether you...
Oh. What Stefano pointed out was
there are so many things varying in the telescope at this level, at this micro arc second level, that we can only solve that with reference stars in the same field as the Cepheids. And there were only about 8 Cepheids that had sufficient reference stars at the sufficient brightness level to actually get good signal to noise. So it's almost like having guide stars. It's like you need guide stars to observe a target. And if the guide stars aren't there, and so there's only 8 good Cepheids, or maybe there's 10 with sufficient guide stars.
Yeah. The practical fact is that the stability of the telescope for photometric measurements when scanning is sufficient to do much better than 1%. So photometric measurements, scanning very fast, are easy. They're not easy, but they really don't present any unknown, any difficulties that they're insurmountable. But once you start trying to measure things at the level of 1,000th of a pixel, there are changes, like, for example, in the thermal environment of the telescope or in the geometric distortion due to small motions of optical parts, etc., they become important and need to be calibrated out. For that purpose, and I mean, I give a 1-hour talk on that, but for that purpose, you need at least 20 good targets, good reference stars, that in this small 3-arc-minute field of view of WC3 UVIS, and that's not always available. They have to be smart, they have to be bright, because otherwise their measurements are not good enough. So that's the limiting factor that Adam is referring to. So
I think we're all excitedly waiting for DR3.
Yeah, a guy uses a half a degree, that's a little better.
the extra Cepheids that you're observing now, what's the brightness range?
They are in the same range, roughly, a little bit brighter.
Okay.
Probably.
6 to 12.
Okay, yeah. And when is cycle 27 finished?
Excuse me?
When is cycle 27 over?
So cycle 27 starts in October, it's a year. But because it's a SNAP program, it will actually go for 2 years, a second year at lower priority.
Okay.
So we may be getting data anytime between October and, 2 years later.
Yeah,
but one thing, this is something that's important, I forgot to mention, is that one thing we'll be able to do by improving our understanding of the Cepheids, by having more of them, we will be able to do some more cross-checks with any DR3 improvements and vice versa, of course. So hopefully we'll be able to do a better job there.
Stefano, the new snapshot program seems really cool. Can you just clarify, were you accounting for the 50% snapshot yield when you showed your forecast, or was that assuming?
That's why I said 1% instead of 0.8%. The forecast is 0.8% if we had all of the measurements, but it's more like 1% if we do.
We're actually getting two ethics.
Yes.
Three quarters of them will at least get one ethic.
Yeah. So it's 40%, it's 40 Cepheids, but two observations per Cepheid to try and compensate for any change in that.
Other questions or discussion?
Well, you're fitting also for the 0 point, right? So in other words, if I understand well, you force the Gaia data to be on the 0 point from HST parallaxes, right?
No, so we could do that, but the HST parallaxes, basically we want to do much better than the HST parallaxes in terms of precision. So although the HST parallaxes can be also used, we are doing that as a separate step. So the calibration of the 0 point or the offset for the Gaia DR2 parallaxes or DR3 parallaxes is based primarily on the photometry for those Cepheids. We do not use at the same time the HST parallaxes. We use the HST parallaxes in the global solution. So that's another anchor which is included in the global solution. It's not included in this particular item, which is correcting for the 0 point for the 0 point of the parallaxes.
But you calculate the offset between HST and Gaia, right?
We calculate the offset on the basis of the assumption that there has to be a linear relationship between the period, the luminosity obtained from the period of the Cepheids and the measured Gaia parallax. That relationship is only linear if you put in the right offset. Otherwise, it will not be linear. It will be linear with an offset, right? So that is a completely separate process from the solution for H0, which will include also the HST parallaxes because they are one of the anchors. So one could, in principle, do everything together, but there are so many specific issues that may be related to understanding very well the Gaia measurements that we do this as a separate.
But in such a case, you will have systematics from Gaia data and from your solution, right? You will have two sources of systematics.
We certainly have systematics from any measurement, of course. The idea is that the particular systematic that's represented by the offset in the parallax measurements for DR2 is identified and taken and measured directly from the data, as opposed to having it as an unknown to be determined later.
I mean, we're turning the systematic of the 0 point into a statistical error.
Right, exactly. By solving for these two parameters.
Your statistical error comes down because you've got your 50 stars, right? So it's, but you don't actually have actual parallaxes.
No, we're not using actual parallaxes.
Yeah.
We're only saying that if there is to be a proportionality, and if the proportionality doesn't go through zero, then that's an offset that needs to be taken out.
Right. So there's a 0 point of the Cepheid PL relation, and there's a 0 point of the Gaia parallaxes. One is multiplicative, and one is additive. So they can be separated without saying anything about either of them. And then you suck up the fact that you're going to have some uncertainty from one going into the other. So
and you have covariance as well. And you have covariance between the two. It's important to keep in mind that we do have covariance to take into account.
So I'm not sure I completely understand that either. So do you assume a slope to the PL relation ahead of time?
Yes.
Is that right? Okay, so that...
No.
Right. Okay, so could it be that these Cepheids have a different slope than the LMC Cepheids in the PL relation? Could that be a different explanation or not?
So well established from many different.
I understand, but
but you know, another way of saying it, when you get down to 1% precision, 1% accuracy, you know, will you find these kinds of things? And that's a fair point.
Yeah. So the slope is assumed in doing this particular step.
Oh.
is assumed from the LMC, and the slope is actually solved for in the global H naught solution. That is not, there's a free parameter there. In this particular drill down to the determining the zero point of the parallax zero point for Gaia, the slope is assumed. If we change the slope, I've not thought through what would change if we change slope.
Curious if that.
It's a good question. If you use a similar period range, then you're not particularly sensitive to the slope either. So.
Right. For the sample of 50, they're all relatively long period. For this new 40, there will be somewhat different slope. So we may play around with that once we have the data.
Okay. Let's thank Stefano again. And Anthony, you want to come up and Victor, sorry. Thank you.